Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the Washington County Historical Association on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by John Bisbee, a retired professor of biology, currently living in Fort Collins, Colorado, and author of Captaining the Corps d'Afrique, the Civil War Diaries and Letters of John Newton Chamberlain. Captain Chamberlain, the great-grandfather of Dr. Bisbee, was the commander of the 1st Louisiana Native Guard, one of the first all-black regiments to fight in the Union Army during the American Civil War. The title of Dr. Bisbee's talk will be A Union Captain's Stories of War in the South. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, November 30th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Washington County Historical Association, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Julie Ashton, the director of the Washington County Historical Association Museum.
John Bisbee is a retired biology professor who grew up on a farm in Washington County, and he now lives in Fort Collins, Colorado. After graduating from Blair High School, he obtained an undergraduate degree in biology from St. Olaf College in Minnesota and then a PhD at the University of Pittsburgh. He taught at universities in Chicago and Hickory, North Carolina for almost 30 years. He and his wife of 51 years retired to Fort Collins in 2004, and here's Carol in the front row. John has been interested in family history for a long time and grew up playing with some of his great-grandfather John Chamberlain's military equipment. At least 20 years ago, he started reading some of his Civil War letters. With the help of an Oregon relative, he gathered over 100 of his great-grandfather's letters. Those letters and his diaries became the basis for a book that John will be talking about tonight. The book was published by McFarland Publishers in June of 2016. This book traces Chamberlain's story of his 4.5 years of service for the Union Army in the southern United States. Chamberlain recorded his unique perspective as a commander of black soldiers and engineers. His letters and diaries, presented in historical context, give an insider's view of the Union Army's relationship with black troops and of the political and social implications of wartime events. Late in the Civil War, Chamberlain's correspondence focused on a schoolmate, Anna Bullock, who later became his wife. Please join me in welcoming John Bisbee back to Washington County.
When you don't know what to say, you bring in an expert. Thank you, Julie. Thank you all for being here. Julie and Faith and I started corresponding a while ago because this museum has my great-grandfather's uniform and musket. They didn't know who I was or what was going on, so they invited me, and they were in for some surprises, and they'll probably continue to be. Once again, glad you're all here. We used to live in North Carolina along the way, and this kind of weather, they would have canceled school. I mean, you know, one snowflake. Anyway, but I'm glad you're here. As I say, I would encourage your questions as we go along to clarify things or whatever, and certainly at the end as well. But encourage that, I want to start with a few questions myself, for that is for you people. One question is, how many of you people in the audience are related to me? Those of you who, the last name Warwick is probably the name that most of these people have. Well, Sharon has married and she does it anyway, but whatever. Anyway, second question, is there anybody here who went to high school with me? I was at Blair High from 57 to 61. That's probably harder to... Yes, that's right, my cousin. And another person. Yes, two people. All right. Wow, we survived. Okay, few questions about the war then. I'll give you three choices for this one. What was the cause of the Civil War? Slavery, states' rights, punishment for secession. How many say slavery? Few say slavery. States' rights. A lot of people say that. Punishment for secession. A few say that. Okay. Well, I don't know the answer, so. My great-grandfather would certainly tell you that it was slavery. Let's see. Let me skip that question. As you heard in the intro, my great-grandfather, for a time, captained black soldiers. So from the beginning of the war, the Union utilized black military people in all military branches, only in the Navy or only in the Army, you know? Actually, Navy. Beginning of the war, black military people were allowed to be in the Navy by law, not in the Army. And that changed, of course, as you certainly know. Black Union soldiers were commanded by, once again, a choice, only black officers, only white officers, mainly white officers. Mainly white. The initial times they were recruited, there were a few black officers. Probably prejudice reasons and other reasons, they were moved out. Unfortunately, I would tend to say, but the white Union officers had to have military experience, and that would be an advantage in terms of captaining or commanding blacks who, in many cases, had not fought before, had minimal training, etc. They were primarily slaves that had been recruited. Okay. So I'll tell you some stories about the Civil War and some historical events, etc. And one of the key people is my great-grandmother. No, she's my grandmother. Mabel Chamberlain Bisbee was one of John Newton's daughters. And she saved all of these letters and diaries and documents and uniforms and things like that. So that allowed me to put together a story. I'm going to tell you a few stories. It will probably be a little disjointed. I can't provide you a complete story in the 5 minutes we have left or whatever it is. My grandfather, Leroy Bisbee, who grew up on a farm, his father homesteaded in western Washington County. Anyway, my grandfather took all kinds of pictures. I've got all kinds of pictures from 1905 through 1915 that were on glass negatives. And is Jeff here? Did Jeff make it? Nope, he didn't. A person at the May Museum in Fremont took all these images and converted them to CD and digital images. And anyway, so onto the story. John Chamberlain, who we saw temporarily a few minutes ago, grew up in upstate New York. In September of 61, he enlisted in the 75th New York Volunteers. His parents said, "There's enough ruffians already enlisted. Why do you have to get involved?" Well, he didn't listen to them. He trained in New York, trained near his home, in fact, near Auburn and Syracuse, if that means anything to you. And in about December, he got a little ride on this deluxe. At that time, it had been a transatlantic steamer, the Baltic. He and the 75th New York Volunteers headed to Florida. He was seasick the whole time. So in December of 61, excuse me, they arrived in western Florida. They came into Fort Pickens on a barrier island. Pensacola was out in Pensacola Bay, etc. He said that time at this fort was kind of boring, 3 to 5 hours a day of drilling was about all he had to do. One little thing he and his roommate found to do: there were ships that went aground on the island, and he and his roommate would go and buy food. Bananas? No. I don't think they got bananas. Butter. How about that? Butter, raisins, herring, whatever. And turned it around, sold it for a little bit more to fellow soldiers who, what, didn't have enough food? I don't know. But anyway, he entertained himself, if you would. In May of 62 now, the Union forces from this fort bombarded and took Pensacola. My great-grandfather recorded what they said about it. He says, probably two-thirds of the inhabitants had fled before we arrived, the Union soldiers. Those who remain are much disappointed in our appearance and behavior. Many of them really thought that the damn Yankees were perfect devils, ferocious wild beasts. They supposed that as soon as the city was occupied by our troops, the place would be pillaged and no person's life would be safe. In fact, many who fled thought there would be an indiscriminate slaughter of all without regard to age or sex. Since the people have found out what we are like, that we have neither hooves nor horns, they began to return and occupy their houses. About the same time, May of 62, the Union forces were also taking New Orleans. It was the second city in the South taken by the Union. It was obviously a very important place along the Mississippi River, etc. And in September of 62, John Chamberlain and his outfit, the 75th New York Volunteers, moved to New Orleans. Initially, he was in a company that was guarding one of the generals, General Arnold by name, and it seems he had pretty nice housing. He described his housing in New Orleans. Our new quarters are in a fine four-story dwelling house at the corner of Rampart and Dolphin Streets. And those streets run parallel to themselves. So something got lost in the translation. I occupy a splendid room about 15 by 20 together with seven others of our men. I am now writing on a beautiful maple top stand. There is a drawer in it where I can keep my writing material and gloves, etc. Shelves beneath, which I use as a cupboard. Table is mahogany, finished in beautiful style. Then, note this, two others and I occupy a splendid mahogany bedstead with very thick mattress of Spanish moss. Probably better than sleeping on the ground, I don't know. We have a large mirror and everything in the most voluptuous style imaginable. The room adjoining is a bathroom with a pump for raising water from below so that we have a good chance to keep clean. Quite fine accommodations that wouldn't last, as you certainly would know. The commander, the Union commander, the Union mayor of New Orleans at this time was a General Butler, a Benjamin Butler. Previously, the year before, he had been stationed in Virginia, where he originated or suggested a new definition of the term contraband. Contraband, as you probably are generally familiar, referring to supplies that an enemy holds that the other side could take. He suggested that that term could also apply to slaves that were being used or being put into labor by the rebels, that were helping the rebels, thus giving a basis, militarily at least, for the Union taking slaves from the other side. When General Butler moved to New Orleans in, I don't know when, 62 sometime, probably May, but anyway, he started hiring slaves to do work for the Union Army. And in late 62, when the Union soldiers were running low, well, when the Union Army was running low on soldiers, he turned for the first time in the Civil War to recruiting blacks, primarily slaves, but some freed because New Orleans had free blacks, turned to recruiting black soldiers for the first time. The plan was to give those, you answered that question already, I think, many times, white officers, my great-grandfather being one. We'll get to that in a minute. The only section, this would be late 62 probably, 1862, the only section that the rebels controlled was between Vicksburg and Port Hudson. The rest of the Mississippi at that time belonged to the Union. And in then summer of 63, General Grant started working on Vicksburg with soldiers. General Banks and later my great-grandfather were involved at Port Hudson. Port Hudson and as well as the Vicksburg area were held by rebel forces on on bluffs that were very easy to defend, and it was a long, long battle. In end of May of that year, that would be 63, the white soldiers attacked from several directions, attacked Port Hudson, and they did not succeed, and they had numerous losses and did not succeed in taking it. At the end of the day, for the first time in the Civil War, or at least for the first time in a major battle, black soldiers were called into fight. They did not succeed either in taking it, but they demonstrated that they could fight well. And that then opened the possibility, which started occurring in the summer, to recruiting lots more black soldiers. My great-grandfather arrived somewhat later at Port Hudson in the middle of June, and he describes in a brief diary entry, this was a second assault by Union soldiers. Started at 2 in the morn. Our rebels advanced as skirmish. Our regiment advanced to skirmishes to take the enemy works. The scenes and sights of today can never be forgotten. A terrible slaughter without any good results. Lost many killed and wounded. Thank God, I am safe. Well, they went back to siege. This turned into the longest siege in American military history, according to the records I read, 48 days. July 9th, finally, Port Hudson fell. July 4th, a few days earlier, Vicksburg fell. And the Union controlled the entire Mississippi River, right? Supplies could get through. Agricultural products from the Midwest could get to the ocean and be exported. And another result of great importance, as already mentioned, was that black soldiers had demonstrated their ability to fight. So the Union Army turned in earnest to recruiting black soldiers. And my great-grandfather was commissioned a captain. So the book that I have, Captaining the Corps d'Afrique, the African Corps, if you want to think of it that way, the Corps d'Afrique was the units into which black soldiers were placed. That was the term given to them initially. John Chamberlain became a captain of a company in the 3rd Regiment Engineers of the Corps d'Afrique. One of the reasons he seemed to say for accepting this commission as a captain of black soldiers was the way that many of his fellow white officers acted. He said many of them were in the Civil War to get rich. He described one officer's attempt to get rich that didn't turn out too well. This was a few months later, actually, but Captain Corning is the Union officer in question. He led some soldiers to chase down some rebels, and he had the Captain Corning, the Union officer, had purchased cotton at a plantation, so he left a Union soldier to guard it. Well, Captain Corning and his unit got back. The head officer said, "Where's this other guy?" Did they keep track of everyone? Apparently they did. Well, he said, "He's sick. He's resting out there," or something like that. Well, so Corning sent out a picket guard to tell the same story. Picket guard didn't make it because the rebels intercepted him. The Union soldiers sent out a squad, found the guy, arrested the guy. He told his story, and Corning didn't have a good future. My great-grandfather says, "Corning is now under arrest by order of General Weitzel, and it's likely that some of his former cotton and sugar speculation will be investigated, and he may get out of the service in a way he may not be very pleased with." He was discharged. The engineers built bridges, repaired roads, repaired forts, cleared waterways of boats, and handled pontoon boats, among other things, or his engineers did, those kind of things. It was dirty digging, manual work in most cases. One of the first assignments of the 3rd Corps, 3rd Regiment Engineers of John Chamberlain, was to go to Texas. In September of 63, they left on boats from New Orleans area to Sabine Bay, right on the border of Louisiana and Texas. And the there were Union soldiers, there were Union gunboats, and the 3rd Corps engineers were in charge of a pontoon boat, pontoon bridge. Is that a picture you're familiar with? The notion of having lots of little boats and putting planks over them, etc. And to haul them around on land, they had lots of mules to haul the wagons on land. So there was a boat full of mules, among other things that you'll hear about in just a minute. The engineers waited off in the ocean. The gunboats, in the morning of whatever, sometime early in September, went up through the pass up into the bay. There was a very small Confederate fort which had about 5 cannons that were working. They did not fire. The Union gunboats were shooting at them, but they were not getting response. And finally, a couple or three, I think it was two, but anyway, of the Union boats got aground right near the fort. Now you can imagine what was going to happen. The Confederates destroyed the boats. Soldiers were killed, soldiers were captured, soldiers ran away, etc. John Chamberlain and his group were all out at sea. They had no part of it. But in the morning, they were told, we're going back to New Orleans. And on the way back, they hit heavy waves. And the officers, the Union officers, said, well, we can lighten this one boat that's full of mules. And they threw about 300 mules overboard. Now, when they got back, a few days later, and we researched this in the records, we'll assume my great-grandfather is right. On September 12th, he wrote in his diary, the officers and crew of the boat are all under arrest for throwing the mules overboard, which seems appropriate. Okay. Tell you a little more about black soldiers. As I said, I'm just kind of jumping around. My great-grandfather started writing to a friend of his, Anna Bullock. She was 3 years younger than he. They were classmates. They were schoolmates together in New York. And he described to her at her request his soldiers. So I read again from one of his letters. You wish to know all about my company. Well, I will give you a little information on that point. I have 54 black men under my charge in the uniforms of Uncle Sam's children, armed and equipped and ready to fight or work for the downfall of the slaveholders' rebellion and their own freedom at the same time. My company has been in 2 slight skirmishes and were exposed to fire at Port Hudson almost as much as any of the troops there, and they have always behaved well. When I first came among them, they all looked alike to me, and I didn't like to get too near them, but this repugnance has worn away, and I can now see as much difference among them as among white men. And I have many a man in my company that I should feel more honored in taking by the hand than some of my old copperhead friends in Senate, New York, where he grew up, and elsewhere. On the whole, I like my position in the regiment very much, and although I sometimes get almost discouraged and homesick, yet I always try to make the best of the circumstances by which I am surrounded and hope for brighter skies in the morrow. When I first took command of the company, not a man knew B from a broomstick, but I bought some primary reading books, and with a little assistance, quite a number of them can read considerable now. An officer in one of these regiments, if he does his duty by the men under his charge, has very much more to do than an officer in a white regiment. There is so much thinking and planning to do for them, and so many letters to be written to wives and sweethearts for them, and then many of them are anxious to learn to read. And as I indicated, he taught them, many of them, to read. A little broader context of that last point. As you probably know, slaves were not supposed to be taught to read. They were denied reading materials, writing materials, or whatever. So by teaching black soldiers who had mostly been slaves, he was in effect liberating them. Reading, ability to read and write, no doubt, meant liberation from slavery. Another perspective on black soldiers is offered by a man named Frederick Douglass, who was a former slave and an abolitionist. And he told about the effect of being a soldier had on the black men. Quoting Frederick Douglass, "Never since the world began was a better chance offered to a long enslaved and oppressed people. The opportunity is given us to be men. With one courageous resolution, we may blot out the handwriting of the ages against us. Once let the black man get upon his person the brass letters U.S., let him get an eagle on his button, and a musket on his shoulder, and bullets in his pocket, and no power on earth or under the earth can deny that he has earned the right of citizenship in the United States. I say again, this is our chance, and woe betide us if we fail to embrace it." Moving on, as John visited places in Louisiana, as the soldiers moved around, he went by many plantations. But John understood, to some extent, what these Southerners were facing. To quote him again, "I know there is little enough Union sentiment in this part of the state, as I say, central Louisiana, but I tell you it is a very trying position for a man to be placed in here if he is a Union man. Having all his worldly possessions here, we may come and occupy the country, and he will take the oath of allegiance to the United States, the Union Army. Then as soon as we abandon the country, as we did last spring, the rebels immediately take possession, and then who will protect his property? He will be ruined by them at once. On the other hand, if he refuses to take the oath, why then he is a rebel and forfeits his property to us." So you can't win either way. He understood that to some extent. By this time, we're now up to spring of 64. John had been in service almost 3 years. Of course, not gone home, written letters, received letters, received boxes of food and stuff occasionally. But he has indicated in one of the other documents I just read, he was at times a lonely man. One of the things he did, and I'm already clued you into this, is he started writing to Anna Bullock. As I said, Anna Bullock was a friend from his hometown. In 1855, several years earlier, she and her family had moved to Waterloo, Iowa. He finally found her address, and he started writing to her. In his first letter, having not seen her or heard from her in 5 years, "Many long years have passed since our father's family found a home among the people of the far west, Waterloo, Iowa." Okay? "Since that time, there have been many changes among the individuals and changes in the national history. Years of political strife and animosity have ripened into the great civil war, which now shakes the very continent. I have outgrown my bashfulness very much, or I should not have the courage to commence a letter to you at this time. But I have considered the matter well, and know that even if you are a married lady, my ignorance of the fact will be a very good excuse. And I am so far away that I might consider myself safe," okay? "And so I write as I would talk with you if I were to see you in your northern home." The correspondence continued in earnest, and I have lots and lots of letters on both sides of that correspondence. It's not time to talk about them now. Another letter written around the same time by John Chamberlain to his mother. His brother Charles from upstate New York visited him in the New Orleans area in the middle of the Civil War. And quite how you get through all that, maybe, I don't know, down the Mississippi, I'm not sure. But anyway, the letter is written as Charles is leaving. It made me feel almost homesick when he went away. Goodbye and good luck to you was all that either of us could say. The tears would start, but I smothered them back, jumped into the boat, waved a parting farewell, pulled my hat down over my eyes, and in another moment was out of sight in the dense fog that shrouded the bay. Every stroke of the oars seemed to echo with fearful distinctiveness. Alone. Alone. And I must own that I never felt so lonely before. Enshrouded in the fog, the whole animate world seemed dead, and I alone with the stable oarsman, gliding on toward the boundless ocean of the great unknown future. Would I reach a quiet haven at last, or be tossed forever on the rough, tempestuous sea? Would the future bring me good or evil, joy or sorrow? And then the lines of Longfellow occurred to me, he says. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act, act in the living present, heart within and God o'erhead. And I sprang on shore with the determination to do my duty manfully from day to day and leave the disposal of the future with higher power than man's. He and his soldiers went on to unload some boats and other kinds of work. In July of 1864, the black soldiers were now not called Corps d'Afrique. They were the U.S. Colored Infantry or the U.S. Colored Troops, and they had numbers, of course. And the numbers of the regiments were consolidated into a smaller number. Some officers were mustered out of the service. Other officers, like my great-grandfather, was given a choice. He could command, continue to be a captain of a black company that was infantry, or continue with being a black company that was engineers. And one of the key things in his decision was the practice, or at least the stated practice, of the rebels. They said any black soldiers' unit that was captured, they would kill the white officer and enslave all the black soldiers. So he chose engineers, perhaps with the thought that this is a little bit safer than infantry. That's open to question. As I answered a question a few minutes ago, the engineers were doing things that were away from the enemy, sometimes taking ships out of waterways or repairing bridges, although in many cases the bridges were being repaired in front of the enemy. So it was not necessarily safe a thing. One of the other things that I mentioned, and you are then probably generally familiar with, is that they were a pontoon regiment. And so building pontoon bridges meant lining up the boats, laying the boards, tying them together, et cetera, et cetera. Well, envision this picture with rebel soldiers on the hilltops. And that was the case often. They're sitting ducks. Not safe at all. In the fall of 64, John's regiment returned to Pensacola. He had made a circle of sorts. And in the 1865, they went from Pensacola back to Mobile. We'll get to that in a minute. In December of 64, the regiment, 97th Colored Infantry, as it was called, that John was involved in, went up to the border of Alabama and Florida to go to a little town called Pollard. They were to destroy rebel supplies and destroy the rebel railroad. Took them about 3 days, marching 25 to 30 miles a day, getting up at 3 in the morning to get up there. They got up there, burnt the supplies, destroyed the railroad, although the rebels had it back by Christmas. This was early December. And started encountering rebels. And they were called back by courier to Pensacola. So they were heading south. The next couple of days meant getting up at 3 in the morning, and they stopped at Escambia Creek, such I've never heard of. And there were the rebels, and they charged. They shot at them with howitzers. They charged. Several Union soldiers were killed. And they took no prisoners. They did not. They shot all the rebels. The next day, they continued their march backwards, skirmishing all along the way. Another bridge, another battle, another take no prisoners. Finally, a couple days later, they got back to Pensacola. They had to wade a half mile of the ocean, etc. The Confederate general that led the rebels was complimentary to these soldiers. He said, this is St. John Liddell, the Negroes fought well, obstinately, and pressed us back steadily. Now, the chaplain of the Black Regiment had a kind of a mixed message. Our troops performed well, he says, with one exception. They killed prisoners. Some of these troops who had been slaves remembered old grievances and sought to avenge them on such occasions. So we now go to Mobile. The Navy, the Union Navy, had taken these forts, taken Mobile Bay, and by the time the 97th, John Chamberlain, he arrived someplace and started working on forts and pontoon bridges and stuff, ending up in a little town of Blakely, not too far away from Mobile. And if, as my wife and I did 2 years ago, you go to that state park in Blakely, the literature tells you this is the place where the last battle of the Civil War was fought. Well, you got to kind of take that with a little bit of grain of salt. The Union Army took Blakely, and Mobile fell right after that on April 12th. Appomattox, where General Grant received Lee's surrender, that occurred on April 9th. This was after that, if you would. There were battles that occurred, minor battles. Mobile was the last southern city to fall. So in that sense, that may be an accurate statement. But the Union Army was not sure that the Civil War was over. My great-grandfather and his engineering troops and a couple of other units were commanded to build, right near Blakely, a small fort. Well, the war came to an end sometime in the middle of 1865. My great-grandfather wrote, probably primarily to Anna, some thoughts about the end of the war and the aftermath of the war. So I share those as the last thing. Maybe there's one more page here. There we go. First, I quote him. It is a terrible lesson to the people of the North and South alike, for we're not all to blame for the war. Who shall say that the whole fault is with the misguided people of the South, or even with their educated, unprincipled leaders? Did not Northern lust for gold help to remit the fetters upon the limbs of the slave? Ah, those who rebelled against a good government were not the only guilty. The whole machinery of government was corroded by the baleful influence of slavery. The whole body politic was corrupted to the core, and nothing short of the tremendous hurricane of war could clear the political atmosphere again. It teaches us that no nation can persistently follow in a course of sin and crime against any class of our common humanity, but sooner or later, it will receive its just retribution. Let me explain briefly the background for that statement. In the mid-1800s, the major export of the United States, North and South, was cotton. Over 60% of the income produced from imports came from cotton, produced by slaves, of course. That cotton was exported from New York City. It had to be shipped there. Shippers were getting money. Financiers, banks were getting money. It was sent to the foreign countries, and once again, shippers were getting money. It industrialized the cotton. Some of it, of course, stayed in the United States, industrialized New England. A recent book, concisely, we could debate, says enslaved African Americans built the modern United States and indeed the modern world. We depended for slaves on much of our wealth then and even later. The other issue that John brought up has to do with politics. Our Constitution provided initially before the 13th Amendment, etc., provided slaves found in the North had to be returned to their Southern masters. If they were not, you would be fined or something. The North was not safe for slaves that were running away. You're familiar with the Underground Railroad, or at least that term. That it wasn't a railroad per se, but there's a current book who patterns it that way. The Underground Railroad, of course, was only in the North. That's where the slaves had to be protected. They escaped the South. They weren't safe in the North. The Underground Railroad took, actually not that many, but took them to Canada. Another prediction that John made, he suggested there's plenty of secession. He spent his last year out of after the war was over in Mobile, in the vicinity of Mobile, Alabama, in the South. There's plenty of secession in the hearts of the people still, and a century can hardly obliterate the deadly feeling against the North and her institutions. It will be handed down from father to son as a sort of heirloom of intense bitterness and hate. Unfortunately, he was probably fairly accurate. I close on a slightly more positive note. After the war, after his was mustered out, John Chamberlain was mustered out in April of 1866. I need someone to help. He went to Waterloo, Iowa. Saw a young lady there. And went back to New York with a ring on his finger, which his brothers thought was really silly. But, so this is my reminder to make the point to remind you people of this great asset you have, this great museum. I've been very impressed with lots of things here, and they're planning expansions, et cetera, so you can help them out. So thank you for your interest, whatever questions we can take. Thanks.
Is there any record of him continuing in any kind of political aspirations or capacity?
He went back to New York. His new bride, wanted to stay in Iowa. He said, we'll go back to New York for a while, then we'll come back to Iowa, which did not happen. He went back to farming. He got a license to teach school. Whether he taught, I don't know. He taught school before he went in the war. He bought some more farmland. That's the extent. He had five children, and my grandmother Bisbee, who was it was one of his five, etc. But no evidence, no record of any further military or political activity.
Are you named after him directly, or do you know?
I don't know. As when my wife introduced me to her family in Minnesota, they told me there were too many Johns in the family, so I was being not another John. Her father was John, etc. That's not a good answer, but it's a very common name among the Bisbees or maybe some other people, I don't know.
He was obviously a very well-educated man. What was his education?
I don't know for sure. I mean, he went through elementary, maybe some high school. He was 23 or 24 when he enlisted, so he would have had time at least to go through some maybe high school. He taught for a year or two, which would indicate once again some of that. He was clearly very well read. I mean, I quoted you one thing. And very well. He wrote very well, and fortunately his handwriting was also good because we had all these handwritten letters. So he valued learning, he valued reading, he did a lot of reading. He talks about going into plantations that had been deserted and borrowing books. Did he return them? I don't know. But anyway, so he could read more, etc. But that's kind of the picture I have.
Did he have any military experience before the war?
As far as I know, no. He did train for, let's see, went in September and they went south in December, so he had a few months of drill and working with arms.
But he became an officer, so they must have had
right.
some.
He was partway through drill. He was promoted to a corporal. In Florida, he was promoted to be a sergeant. Is this military experience? Is this dependable person? He was that. He was quite conscientious and kept things in order, etc. Basically, it seemed he learned in the war.
Like he was well ahead of his time.
Yeah. And then they recognized that perhaps in terms of commissioning him as a captain and whatever. But we're just filling in pieces.
Right.
Good
Thank
question.
You.
So,
explain again how he became the commander of an engineering company. What gave him the qualifications, or was this just the wisdom of the Army?
Very, very good question. At the point he was commissioned a captain, as far as I know, he, other than perhaps whatever you might have learned on the farm, which I don't know whether that would transfer much, he did not. Now, a year or two into service, he talks about a certain manual that was widely used for training engineers and afternoon training sessions and the recitations with the trained engineers that he really enjoyed. They taught him a lot, and he then taught his troops, and they moved on to doing more complex things than simply moving dirt, et cetera, but making various kinds of baskets and wooden things that were used for fortifications, et cetera. But once again, as you said, my best guess is recognition of his ability. And initially, the engineering work was not complex or anything other than hard labor. And he got along well with his soldiers. That line was left out. My wife
said I wasn't going to say anything. But I did help a lot with this book. And I do remember one point at which when we went to all those forts, and we would say, well, what might he have done? And somewhere along the line they said, or maybe it was in the letters or something, but anyway, they said that because of where he was working, he must have been seen as one of the more talented, one of the more able people, because they put certain people here and other people over there. And he was in the place where they put the good ones.
At Fort Gaines off of Mobile, he was, and I have all these original orders, crazy what relatives say, but they're neat to see. He was positioned as an assistant engineer in charge of all the remedies, all the rebuildings on that fort. So he was recognized by that point as capable, apparently, both in terms of engineering and in terms of delegating, perhaps, et cetera.
This treasure trove of letters, has your family always known of their existence, or had they disappeared and then were they rediscovered, and who has possession of them now?
I'm sure that people probably lost track of the fact that they had them. 25 years ago, maybe, for whatever reason, my mother acquired a bunch of them from, although my grandmother was still alive then, wasn't she? Yeah. Anyway, she sent them off, is this relevant? To a relative to type them. That relative then had others of the letters. She typed those. And that relative knew of a couple of other relatives, one in California. This first typist was in Oregon. The other people were in California and Washington State. And she gradually got those together. And I was corresponding with this relative and said, I'd like to try to write a story. And she said, I don't have time, but I'll help you get them together. Most of the letters that my mother had and gotten typed, she threw away because she had Alzheimer's. There are actual letters then in these other relatives, 40 or 50 or 60 letters. I still have in my possession diaries from 61 through 64. Somebody else has 65. And now what we're doing, what I want to do, and I'm always open to ideas, is get some of these documents into some archives or someplace where they can be preserved. They were in the attic in this farm I grew up on in western Washington County for 100 years or something. But they need to be moved.
Did he ever mention the attitude maybe that some of the other white Union soldiers, their feelings about having a regiment or, you know, a group of black soldiers? Maybe there were a lot of white Union soldiers who would have been unwilling to take a group like that. What was his comment about that?
He didn't seem to comment about the feeling of the other white soldiers, but I think you and I can guess, just as you said, in his letters to family members or even initially to Anna, he said, now people stick up their nose, nasal protuberance, or I don't know what, because of what I'm doing, but I'm doing my duty and I'm doing what I was asked to do. He developed, and I lost that in my notes because we didn't see it. He developed a real bond with his soldiers. They depended on him to lead them. They knew he was in danger. He could be killed, but he still did it. He knew that they had to defend him for his 27th birthday or something. They gave him a gift of $75. This was about 40 troops who were making about $7 a month, giving about a dollar and a half or something. They got along well. That was probably somewhat unusual, but all I can guess is what you said. I mean, he noted the racism of the time most people think they're not deserving of labor or they're whatever. But he said, they're God's creatures just as much as we are. Now, he said, and it's part of his time, I don't think they have the intelligence of white people. Yet he applauded them. He did everything he could for them. So that's kind of a mixed comment on your statement.
From the time that he enlisted, how long did it take for him to become captain?
Okay, so September of 61 to September of 63.
Wow, that's fast.
So that's simple, but good point. And I hadn't calculated that before.
Just a quick question. Besides the letters, what other resources did you call on to write your book?
Well, as I mentioned, I had access to 4.5 years of diaries. They were a lot of information on little specific points. He often wrote long letters that were quite verbose. But anyway, I have quite a 20 or so of different documents, orders, plans for forts, things like that. Then the rest was all historical research. We live in Fort Collins. CSU, Colorado State University, happens to have a very good collection of Civil War documents, including there's a several hundred volume set called The Official Records of the Army and Navies of the Confederacy and the Union Soldiers. And that was one of the sources. Yeah, but a lot of research in books there and a lot of online research, and that's why it took 4 years. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Washington County Historical Association on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by John Bisbee, a retired professor of biology currently living in Fort Collins, Colorado, and author of Captaining the Corps d'Afrique, The Civil War Diaries and Letters of John Newton Chamberlain. Captain Chamberlain, the great-grandfather of Dr. Bisbee, was the commander of the 1st Louisiana Native Guard, one of the first all-black regiments to fight in the Union Army during the American Civil War. The title of Dr. Bisbee's talk was A Union Captain's Stories of War in the South. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, November 30, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Julie Ashton, director of the Washington County Historical Association Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next event in the Washington County Historical Association Speaker Series will be this Thursday, August 3rd at 7 o'clock p.m. at the Washington County Historical Association Museum in Fort Calhoun, Nebraska. The guest speaker will be Matthew Sitting Bear Jones, a retired professor and member of the Oto Nation. He'll speak on the topic, The Oto-Missouria Tribe, the Forgotten Nebraskans, and the impact this tribe had on our present-day Nebraska. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.